This is the Pitch Fishing Gannaby Cricket Show number 178. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Fishing Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchfishing.com. You can call us on
02088167691.
And you can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
My name's David Hinchliffe, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway and Berners. Welcome to the show, Garras, Berners. Big week, everybody.
Yeah, very big week. I'm back at school. All kids come in. We're just building programs now and getting ready for a good winter of development work.
Yeah, and you're keeping things real in the Pitch Vision offices this week, Berners.
I am indeed. It's all very corporate, but when you're launching a brand new system like PV1, you've got to be focused. You've got to be dedicated. And you've got to be in Staines, and that's where I am today, folks.
And for our international listeners, how would you describe Staines, Berners?
Slightly bland, with a lot of people, a lot of offices, and a lot of traffic.
Well, let's move on to cricketing matters, and there are some exciting things happening in the world of cricket. The Indian season, domestic season, is about to kick off. And, of course, the start of the Indian domestic season is the Challenger Trophy, where you have the best of the domestic players take each other on in a one-day series. India, I think they change it now to green and red and blue, haven't they, for the three
that's
colours?
Right. That's right.
Yeah, so that's exciting because you sort of get to see some real top players in a kind of trial for the Indian season. So, Gareth, are you looking forward to that?
I am, and more importantly, I think Duncan Fletcher will be looking forward to it, because it's a great opportunity for him to see all the players playing highly pressurised cricket, which is directly linked to selection going forward as he plans for the next few years. And it's a model that I'm surprised didn't happen in more places around the world. And I think in England it would be difficult because of the just amount of cricket that's played within a very short window of the English county season, but certainly in other places, I'd suggest somewhere, you know, like a New Zealand or a South Africa, where there's a limited number of franchises that play over there. I think it's a brilliant way of seeing who's got what and who's coming through, and I'm sure he'll have a player or two from it and put those into his plan.
It got me to thinking as well a little bit about limited over cricket, because of course you had your recent article on the Pitch Vision Academy, Mark, which was regarding power hitting and helping batsmen improve their power hitting. And of course the other main skill, which people generally get pushed into two different areas, don't they? They're either a hitter or a touch player, and they rotate the strike. And I was thinking, which one of those skills, if you had to pick one of those skills, a guy who can rotate the strike or a guy who can biff it at the end, that's the headline grabber. But which one of those skills do you like to see in a player?
Well, personally, I like to see people who can hit the ball. And the reason why I say that is that most of the singles, I don't think it is a touch game anymore. I think there's a few very good touch players out there, but I think we should be encouraging our players to hit hard and hit down the ground, because that's actually where the singles come as well. That's how you rotate the strike. So it was something that we introduced with England around 2008 when we played against South Africa. It was hitting the ball along the ground and hard with straight batted shots. So hitting deep mid on, hitting deep mid off, hitting deep cover, because it guaranteed us a single, guaranteed a rotation of strike. It kept our scoring ball percentage. We're now in a position where our singles become deep mid off, deep mid on, and deep cover.
Now that's interesting, because a lot of what I see, certainly at club level, is you get guys who tend to be quite good at the big hits and not so good at picking up those singles in the middle overs and things like that. So if you were working with a club side and you had a team like that, would that make any difference, or would you still be saying, look, let's work on the big hits, because the singles come off the back of that?
Well, the only difference really between the big hits and getting a single out of deep mid on is the point of contact with the ball. And obviously to get the ball over the top, you've got to make contact with the ball slightly earlier to get the elevation. So You know, your body positions don't change that significantly. You can still hit the ball hard and along the ground. You just need to be making contact with it a little bit later. So the way that I would develop that, and particularly developing the ball hit deep mid-on, because most bowlers come from the offside of the stumps, whether it be a left-arm spinner coming around the wicket or whether it be a right-arm over. The plan of attack would be to hit the ball along the ground to deep mid-on, using your non-striker as a blocker, because he's going to block the bowler going across, particularly when it's spinners, and you pick up easy singles hitting the ball hard and along the ground to deep mid-on. You know, most sides now don't have their mid-on up in a circle for a long time within 50-over cricket, and certainly not within 20-over cricket. So we've got to be able to hit deep mid-on. So that would be all I'd do with a club side, is I'd get them to practice beating the bowler. And I think it's a fantastic drill to do, whether you've got fielders in place or whether you put cones down, is just get used to hitting the ball hard along the ground and beating the bowler on either side, because you give yourself guaranteed singles.
And so a good way to practice that would be the power hitting series that you did on the Pitch Vision Academy website, Gareth.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's a brilliant drill, and it's fun. And I mean, and we've got to keep introducing fun into our practices as well, because that's how you motivate people. And you can have a real good player around with that. And then obviously the extension onto the power hitting one is to still hit the same areas, those three circles that we've got on the pitch that anybody sees when they refer to that article, and then actually hit the ball along the ground, you know, into those circles, as well as hitting them in the air into those circles or over the top of those circles. So they're great areas to hit. And you know, players will often hear me say fantastic area, great angle when we're having a net. So, you know, if somebody hits one in over the top of extra cover, I'll always talk about great angles, because they're undefended areas, and we've got to get very good at hitting undefended areas.
Okay, let's finish off this section with our yes no round. Every week, Gareth and I get to answer just yes or no to the three questions that Berners presents to us. We might want to say more, but we can't. So, Berners, what are your three questions this week?
Okay, first question. It's time for Tendulkar to bow out.
No.
Yes.
Second question. Ambidextrous batsmen are the next big innovation in T20 cricket.
Yes.
No.
Third question. You never see a good side with a bad wicketkeeper.
Yes.
No.
We're never far from a discussion on fast bowling on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. It's one of the most popular topics that we get questions for from the listeners, and one of the biggest questions that search for on the site as well. So this week on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, I'm delighted to be joined by Mark Kinn, a lecturer and a researcher at Loughborough University. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and I hope I can provide some useful information, I guess.
So some of your research is into fast bowling. So can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing to do with that?
Yes, certainly. I mean, I came on board with the ECB back in about 2004 when Troy Cooley was the national coach for fast bowling. And the challenge back then was to really start to understand what fast bowling looks like and understand what limits performance in pace. And to be honest, those questions are still there now, 8 years later. The ECB have funded a variety of research. They've been very proactive, saying we don't have all the answers, and so they brought me on board to try and help get to the bottom of some of these things revolving around how we can bowl faster.
Now, there'll be coaches listening to this. You say, well, you know, I know what the answer is. You just need to, you know, do such and such with your front arm, or, you know, brace
that,
your front leg.
Yes, but I would challenge that, and I think I ask lots of questions as a biomechanist, so I'm not a coach. And I think that's quite important to distinguish between what a coach will do and what a biomechanist will do. So as a biomechanist, I would say, let's take something simple like run-up speed. To bowl fast, you might think you've got to run up fast. Well, that's true to a point. But if you think about it more and you say, well, what's the optimum run-up speed? So how fast should an individual run up so that they get the best out of their bowling action? Well, as a coach, you might put a wet finger in the air and say, I think it should be about, I don't know, in my terms, about 5 metres per second. But if they ran up a little bit quicker, would they bowl faster? Or do they need to be stronger to cope with that run-up speed? And that they, once you start to think about these questions, they become quite difficult to answer. So if you're a coach of a group of 15 bowlers, and they're all similar shapes and sizes, should you coach them all to run up at the same speed or not? And how do you answer that question? And that's where I try to come in as the biomechanist. Don't say I've got the answers, but I understand the question.
So what have you been able to find out in your years of research?
Yeah, well, so the ECB funded a project, and this was done by Peter Worthington, who's finished his PhD now. And so he was tasked with identifying across our elite bowlers, so this is from the test team down, what are the common characteristics that they all show? And are the common characteristics across a cohort? So if we look at their pace, and that varies across the group, what technical factors, not ignoring things like strength and shape and size, are there technical characteristics that all of the bowlers do? And so when we did that, there were a number of factors that came out. And so these became the characteristics of what we think pace looks like. But that doesn't mean we're in a position yet to coach that. Because as I explained with run-up speed, you don't know where a particular bowler is on the continuum between, you know, a variable is important, but you don't know where they are on it to say, should they do more of it or less of it to get the best out of themselves.
How do you find that out individually for each person? Is that still a question that's unanswered?
So for the individual, it's hard to answer that question because you can't really do too many experiments on the individual. So the individual comes in, they bowl. And essentially, if they bowl 10 deliveries, within reason, they're all the same. So if you plot anything on a graph, you get one data point. So it says, for example, for a run-up speed of 6 metres per second, I bowled 85 mile an hour. So what you don't have is if they run up a bit quicker or a bit slower, what happened to their pace? And so experimentally, this is a challenge. And so although we found lots of things out, we're still not yet in a position where we can perhaps use this as well as we could in coaching. And so the ECB have decided to fund an ongoing project, which is happening now, to try and address that question using something called computer modelling.
And what is the scope of that study?
Well, computer modelling, I mean, I'm sure most of your listeners have played a computer game at some point or other in their life. And essentially, you press the keys and things happen on the screen. Well, if you imagine that that was a fast bowler, and that fast bowler represented an individual, and you could say, change how fast they run up and observe the effect on their performance, you could then understand for an individual where the best speed for them to run up would be to achieve a certain outcome. And that's what computer modelling essentially is. There's obviously more than just run-up speed as a variable, but you take a number of variables, you have a model that represents an individual bowler, you're then able to investigate for the individual what combination of variables or factors should result in the best outcome. And that's the project that's ongoing at the moment.
Now, that's going to be a while before you find out exactly what you need to find out in that particular area. Yep. But I'm just thinking of people now who are listening. Maybe you're a 15-year-old fast bowler. Yep. Your ambition is to, you know, get up to bowling at, you know, 165 kilometres an hour, really get the ball down the other end super quick. Is there any kind of practical advice? I understand that you're not a coach, but is there any kind of practical advice you can say to somebody in that particular situation?
I think what's come out of the research, if you look back at, and not from a coaching perspective, but you can go back to 10 years, 15 years, and maybe in some instances still now, there was a lot of emphasis on what did the bowler look like at back foot contact. Well, how were they characterised? Were they side on? Were they midway? Were they front on? Those sort of terminologies. And I think things have moved on since then. So things like mixed actions, I don't think we're so concerned about those anymore, which is quite a change to what was thought in the past. And the emphasis had really turned far more to what's happening at front foot contact. So for a right-handed bowler, when their left foot hits the ground. And it's there that, from a performance and an injury perspective, that things are happening. So I think the things, rather than worrying about their setup so much at the beginning, as long as they're not falling over and they're, you know, they're not crossing their legs and doing silly things, as long as it looks so, you know, reasonable, I think the emphasis has changed far more to what's happening at front foot contact. I think the challenge still, though, is if you take a bowler at 14, 15, and they are going to end up, maybe they're Jimmy Anderson at 14, 15. Mm-hmm. What does he look like then if he's going to be world class when he's 25? And what's the right way to progress that person? Because they're not as big and as strong. They can't cope with the holding an action in the way that a fully developed adult can. And so I'm reluctant, and it's quite difficult to say, what should you be encouraging that 15-year-old to do? Because I don't think we yet understand that progression from there through to adulthood. And what should you be encouraging in the young person, given their size, strength and shape, so that they will achieve their best when they're older? And that's really the goal, is, you know, what's the path for a player to go from being young to old, so that they get to get the best out of them, whatever that is. Not everybody can be world class, but what you'd hope is every individual can reach their potential, whatever that may be.
Well, it's certainly food for thought, Mark. Thank you very much for coming on to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show today.
It's a pleasure, and thank you very much for your time.
Time now to open the mailbag and to answer your questions. Of course, the best question every week wins a prize, which is an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So we got two questions. I think one's a little bit of follow-up from last week, which is good news. So, Berners, what are the two questions this week?
Our first question comes in from Ramesh, and he's going to be involved in a cricket tournament in their city. They're going to be playing at four different venues, and he's saying the pitches are quite unpredictable, and he doesn't know how they're going to behave on the match day. As a batsman, how do you vary your game according to the pitch conditions? Are there any technical changes required, or do you just trust your muscle memories whilst playing?
Personally, I wouldn't make too many large changes to the way that you play, purely that, as you said, you've got a certain style of playing and a certain way of playing which has brought you success. So if you start worrying about what happens if I get a ball which, you know, bounces off a length and goes past my nose, then you're just putting fear into your mind when you don't really need to do that. So obviously, if you know from past history some of the scores on those grounds, and those grounds are not high scoring grounds because the pitches have historically been poor, then it's probably worth, when you first go out, having a look and seeing what you can, seeing how it behaves with your openers and your number three or number four, and watch the conditions of the pitch. If you're not playing the first game in that tournament, it's a great idea to go along and watch, see how the pitch behaves against different types of bowling, and pick up as much information as you can before you go into bat. And then when you're out there, you know, don't be afraid to take a few balls to have a look and make sure that you understand how the pitch is playing before you go for it completely. Even in a 2020 format on a flat pitch, someone like Chris Gayle, he doesn't score quickly in his first few balls. He takes that time to have a look. And then once he's decided that he can score quickly on this pitch against these bowlers, he goes for it. So I don't think there's any reason to make any massive changes to your tactics, because you'll end up overthinking things and getting confused and not playing your best.
It is a case of watching what happens, and as you say, the ideal situation is to be able to see a game that's played beforehand. If it is a tournament and there's a couple of games on in the day and you're second, you know, learn from what happened before, and that's what I think, disappointed me a little bit in the T20 finals in the UK recently, where the first game was played, and it was obviously a bit of a slower wicket than maybe people wanted. And Somerset in particular, when they chose to have a bat first, I think they didn't apply themselves to the pitch. And you don't have to change the way that you play, but you have to be respectful of the conditions that you're in. So if you are an all-blazing side, then, you know, you might have to lower your sights a little bit. You can still hit the ball hard, but it might not be a pitch that you can access the boundary on a regular basis, and it might be that hard hit singles become more important than the odd boundary. So I always said that KP, you know, he would always watch the game really, really hard, and in fact when he got out he'd always be right back sitting next to me within two or three balls. And what he's doing there, even in a one day game, is he's taking in information, because there's a good chance that he'll be playing on that ground again at some point in his career, or there might be a second innings if it's a test match, or you might be playing back to back ODI games on the same pitch. And I think the same applies for us as club cricketers as well, because invariably we play at the same venues each year, and the more information that you can gather will inform you going into next year's game or next week's game on that particular ground, and you can apply your basics, your technique, more appropriately. And often it's the side that applies their basics appropriately that wins the game, particularly in low scoring games on unpredictable wickets, as the question alludes to.
Next question comes in from Tom, and he asked us a question a couple of weeks ago, which we answered, and he's just given us a little bit of an update. It sounds like a bit of a star. He's just saying, thanks for answering my question. I've been concentrating very hard on seam position, and the ball seems to land on the seam facing first slip. Do you think that's a good angle? He's only 14, so he's saying that he's not bowling at an orthodox pace that a normal spinner would, and he reckons he comes in around 37 miles an hour, which obviously does have a bearing on the amount of spin he can create. And he's asking what we think about that pace for a 14-year-old, and also saying that he manages to beat the bats quite a bit, but not getting many edges caught behind. He's taken 51 wickets this year, and he's top of the whole club. So he's pretty happy, but just wants us to give him a bit of a follow-up on what he's doing and what we think about that.
Just before you answer that, Gareth, just for the background information, it's Tom who was the leg spinner from last week.
Yes, and, I remember, yeah.
Yeah, and he was, we weren't quite sure what his problem is, but I think he's super keen is more of his thing. So he's taking a lot of wickets with whatever he's doing. So there's really two parts of the question, which is what do we think about the seam position, and what do we think about the pace that he bowls at?
Well, pace-wise, if you talk to Terry Jenner, he would say there is no such thing as an ideal pace in terms of a number. The ideal pace is the pace of the ball that you can bowl, which gets maximum spin off or break off a wicket. So it sounds as if 37 miles an hour might be your pace at the moment as a 14-year-old. Get stronger and get older and taller, you'll probably find that your pace will go up. I think that there's a tendency for people to try and bowl it too quick sometimes, and that stops them from getting the maximum break. But Terry would always be very, very keen on bowling the ball at your pace, which allows you to get the maximum break off of the wicket, because that's your point of difference as a leg spinner as opposed to any other type of spinner, is the amount of spin and you can get in the air and the amount of break you can get off of the pitch. So it sounds as if 37 miles an hour is working for you. The other thing I'd say is leg spinners, yeah, you're gonna get plays and misses. It doesn't matter what standard of cricket you end up playing in, the ball's going to beat the bat. And as much as Shane Warne got, you know, 700-800 test wickets, he'd have beaten the bat considerably more times than that, and it is particularly to right-handers. And it's something that, you know, you do have to factor in and get used to. The other thing to consider is if you're going really well and you keep progressing and you keep working hard, then you're going to come across better batters, and the better batters are more likely to get edges on those balls, and you'll also be bowling to better keepers and better first slips as well, and so you'll get more rewards. So keep doing what you're doing. In terms of your seam position, there are benefits for different angles of seam. because the ideal for maximum break spin off of the wicket would be to land the ball at 90 degrees to the pitch, but then you'd be negating any drift that you could get, and drift is a very important part of a leg spinner, because you want to try and get somebody's eyes moving from, if I'm a right-handed batter, moving towards leg side for then that break off of the pitch to open up my stumps or open up my my outside edge. So I think the angle that you've got at the moment sort of does the best of both worlds. It gives you some good spin option off of a wicket, some good break option off of a wicket, but also gives you the option of drifting the ball and deviating it in the air and causing the batter some issues as a result of that. So it sounds good, but I would encourage you to play around with a slightly different grip or release position, which gets the ball to go down with almost the half of the ball looking at you, so the seam staying on top of the ball, and just seeing whether that is an option for you as well. And Shane Warne wouldn't release every ball with the same seam angle, because then it can become predictable. So, you know, mastering different seam angles and seeing what result that gives you is part and parcel of the growth of any spinner, whether it be an orthodox spinner or, in this case, a wrist spinner who bowls leg spin.
Yeah, and I think the key message is for Tom, certainly I think this, and I'm sure you're with me, Gareth, is that if what he's doing at the moment is working, in other words, if he's getting 51 wickets in a English summer, then he's doing a good job, and he can experiment with other things, but as long as he is taking wickets with the method that he's using, and whether that's bowling at 37 miles an hour with the seam position as it is, then great, use that as your stock delivery, and don't worry if it doesn't all go 100% according to plan all the time. The key thing is you're taking wickets.
I've scored 51 runs this season, let alone 51 wickets. Well done, Tom.
No, it is good, but you can... But I think it's an easy thing to do without having to change any action or your mechanics, is just to have a look at shifting the seam around in the hand, and seeing if you can get extra spin, or whether one ball will deviate more through the air and become an LBW ball. I think it's, you know, once you've got your basics right, your action right, you can play around with things, and especially in practice. But, you know, as you say, the stop ball is really important, and if that's your stop ball, then stick with it. But if you can vary 5% each way every now and again and master that variation, then you're going to become an incredibly useful bowler. And as we all advocate on this show, you know, get us as many leg spinners as we possibly can, because they're exciting, they get the game going forward, and I think everybody enjoys that.
Yeah, keep going, Tom. You're doing great.
He is doing well. Do we know where he plays? Where's he from?
Let me see if I can find out. Hang on. No, we don't know, I'm afraid. His Twitter account, which is how he contacted us, didn't reveal any more information, apart from he also plays centre midfield during the winter. So, well done, Tom. Keep it up. And he's a drummer as well.
Cool, he's a talented boy by the sound of things. Yeah, good lad. Yeah. Well done, Tom.
Sounds like he's got a good coordination.
Yeah, so keep it all going, Tom. You're doing great. Okay, time for this week's soapbox, and Gareth is climbing onto the box as we speak to give us a minute's rant about something that's getting on his nerves or getting him excited this week.
I'm in a profiling stage of the season, so I'm trying to get as much information on my players as possible. And one of the things that does get my goat a little bit is coaches that don't go through a profiling stage or don't gather information. And the reason why information is important is that it informs us how our development programs are going to go for players. It informs us on the deployment of players within our teams, whether it be with the bat or with the ball or even in the field. And without that information, all we're going on is our interpretation. So information is crucial. I mentioned it in my article this week coming up, a technical profiler, and we're going to go through a few profilers over the course of next week, and hopefully you'll be able to find them useful for yourselves and see if you can change your practice if you are one of those guys, because the information that comes out of it will often confirm what you know, and occasionally will throw up something that may need a shift in your emphasis or a shift in your coaching style with a particular player that can open the door and unlock the secrets that person needs to get extra success.
Right, that's about all we've got time for on the show this week. But before we go, there's just a couple of little things we need to sort out. The first one being the winner of this week's question section. The prize, of course, is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So we had Tom's follow-up question on leg spin and Ramesh's question about unpredictable pitches.
Yeah, well, we're getting some great questions, and it's brilliant that we've had a follow-up question this week from Tom, because we requested it, and I'm going to go with Tom's question because I love people who've got passion that want to continue to develop, and I just thought it was great that somebody wanted to follow up after we'd given an initial answer to his first question. So Tom wins it this week, and good luck, Tom, in his career.
Yes, congratulations, Tom. And if you want to send in your own question to the show, Bernard, how would you do that?
You can give us a call. Our number is 020-88-167-691. Or you can drop us an email, and the address for that is coach@pitchvision.com.
Our Twitter, which Tom got in touch with us via, is @PVCricketCoach. Our Facebook, which you can also put your questions onto our wall there, is facebook.com/PitchVisionAcademy. You can subscribe to the show if you want to listen to everybody's questions every week and get more interviews and such like by heading over to iTunes and doing a search for Pitch Vision Academy, or going to pitchvision.com/academy and clicking on the podcast link at the green bar in the top, and the instructions are in there for how to do that. This week's tail ender is one, it's an older term, but one I haven't heard for a little while, so I thought I'd revive it in memory of the career of Jeremy Snape. A moonball, which we don't see a lot in professional cricket as much anymore since Jeremy retired, but I'm sure it happens in club cricket every week. It's the ball which is thrown up way above the batsman's eye line by a spinner.
I love a moonball, and not only was Snapey a good exponent of it, probably the most famous exponent of it, but Michael Vaughan was a mean purveyor of the moonball, and I remember actually in his last ever won the international, which was at the 2007 World Cup, Vaughan bowled over the wicket to the West Indies left-handers. Chris Gayle was going like the clappers. And all of a sudden, all of the wind went out of Chris Gayle because we had Vaughan bowling moonballs from over the wicket, straight in front of the stumps, pitching it on leg stump, and there was no pace at all for Chris Gayle to go with. And the innings slowed down, and it resulted in a wicket at the other end with Chris Gayle having a huge swing at one and the other bowler getting the wicket. But I'm a big fan of a moonball, and Snapper was brilliant at it, but even Mr. Vaughan was pretty handy with it.
So there we go. If you are struggling for a variation and you're a spinner, then maybe the slightly forgotten moonball is the way to go. That's all for this week. So until next time, we'll see you next week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Bernard.
Cheers, lads.
Cheers, guys.